Back around the turn of the millennium, 20 years or so ago, a persisting dispute erupted in the normally placid dinner meetings of the Old Mole group. Nearly the entirety of those who argued took the then prominent position on the left and elsewhere that the state was withering away, its functions being taken over by corporations and the market. I argued, on the contrary, that only some former functions of the state were being diminished, and that other aspects, especially repressive ones, would grow and would have to grow. Rather than withering, the state as an institution was torquing, not getting smaller as a whole, but lessening in some respects and vastly growing in others. This morning I want to look at how we understand the growing authoritarianism, the growing state repressiveness and ability to repress, not only in the U.S., but in the world. I apologize in advance, as one of my motives clearly is the less than generous impulse to tell my colleagues, "I told you so." That was our theme for Another World is Possible, "We've Got the Guillotine" by The Coup. On Another World is Possible, we examine both the possibilities and the obstacles, both the visions and what stands in the way. We've looked at utopian and dystopian literature, police unions and alternatives to policing, what there is and isn't to learn from a country like Cuba, and the role of citizen scientists in environmental movements. Drawing on history and social psychology, we've begun a discussion on why and under what conditions people are open to rethinking their societies, to recognizing that fundamental alternatives exist. Growing authoritarianism, whether in India, Hungary, Turkey, Brazil, or a multitude of other places, is something the people of the world are up against. In the U.S., we've seen its trajectory increase under Democrat and Republican administrations alike. Replacing a would-be dictator with a more grandfatherly type as president will have little effect on the underlying tendencies unless the factors that produce them are addressed. Thus, today, I want to take a beginning stab at how contemporary social science understands those tendencies and factors.
We might be tempted to think that our democratic heritage automatically protects us from such threats. This is a misguided reflex. In fact, the precedent set by the founders demands that we examine history to understand the deep sources of tyranny and to consider the proper responses to it. Americans today are no wiser than the Europeans who saw democracy yield to fascism, Nazism, or communism in the 20th century. Our one advantage is that we might learn from their experience. Now is a good time to do so.
That was my sidekick for this morning, Patricia Kohlberg, reading from Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Snyder is a professor at Yale. 2 points immediately jump out. First, he's promising to help us understand the deep sources of tyranny in order to combat it. Second, his starting point is the equation of fascism and communism. That starting point is worrisome. I'm wary of approaches that equate the two. Yes, the regime calling itself communist that developed in the Soviet Union was oppressive and authoritarian. Stalinism was tyrannical. But the sources of that tyranny, to use Snyder's language, were different from the sources of tyranny in Germany and Italy. Their political histories, their underlying economic systems, their class formations were different. If we're to understand the deep sources, as promised, those differences are crucial. If we are to head off the growing authoritarianism in our own world, those are factors we can't just glide over. There's another clue in that paragraph from Snyder to the narrowness of what he means by deep sources. It's simply an article of faith for him that what we have now is democracy. Unquestioned, unqualified democracy. He sees no need to consider the ways in which our political system has always reflected the inequities of our social economic system, the ways in which it has facilitated those inequities, the ways, in fact, that what we have is one system that integrates the political, the social, the economic, the ways in which that system generates the language of democracy while blocking its substance. Snyder doesn't see a system at all, and thus looks only at the narrowly political. His deep sources, then, go no deeper than political maneuvering or the power drives that some humans have in excess. His lessons, as a result, are limited. They are good, common-sense bits of advice on being an active individual citizen. They are not about the need to address our economic system that distorts democracy. They are not about the need to join with others to build a movement. Turning from Yale to Harvard, Professor Pippa Norris also studies growing authoritarianism. She and her sometimes co-author, Ronald Engelhardt of the University of Michigan, understand it as a cultural backlash against the decline of traditional values and norms, a reaction by groups that formerly felt comfortable in the world, even if they lacked wealth and political power, but now feel under pressure or bypassed. In other words, they locate the authoritarian impulse not in the power drives of potential tyrants, but in parts of the population that devalue democracy, once racial and sexual minorities, or other groups that have been relatively silenced till recently, seem likely to outvote them. This is perhaps an overly simplistic presentation of their argument, which hinges on the cultural presence of minorities and the hitherto silenced, as much as on their voting. But once again, democracy is understood as formal procedures, as what we already have, instead of as what it should be, authentic power shared by all citizens. We'll revisit these and other academics in a future program in the hope of gaining insights to this problem of growing authoritarianism. For now, I want simply to point out what was predictable years ago. When government social services are cut, when the state's responsibility for the well-being of its citizens is diminished or even denied, when the economic system, through marketization and globalization, is less and less able to provide meaningful and decently paid opportunities for work, the need for ever stronger authority to defend this system grows. Police are militarized, prisons enlarged, organizations of police and corrections officers gain political power. The military expands to sop up unemployment. The executive branch of the government is strengthened. Mass media shift subtly to the right, etc. This has been the pattern under Clinton and Obama, as well as under the Bushes and Trump. Returning to Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny, his conclusion offers an insight.
Until recently, we Americans had convinced ourselves that there was nothing in the future but more of the same. the seemingly distant traumas of fascism, Nazism, and communism seem to be receding into irrelevance. We allowed ourselves to accept the politics of inevitability, the sense that history could move in only one direction, toward liberal democracy. After communism in Eastern Europe came to an end in 1989 to 91, we imbibed the myth of an end of history. In doing so, we lowered our defenses, constrained our imagination, and opened the way for precisely the kinds of regimes we told ourselves could never return.
The system we have now is not inevitable. It could have been different. It can be so in the future. That sense of inevitability is disabling. We'll continue to explore potential alternatives as well as their obstacles. Another world is possible. This has been Norm Diamond on the Old Mole Variety Hour.